It was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking, and I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker's established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Beringer, I buy Cabernet, so should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 77. This month, we feature another visit with Steve Johnson, co-owner of Parallel 44 Winery in Kewaunee, Wisconsin.
A lot has changed in the 2 years since we last spoke with Steve Johnson of Parallel 44 Winery in Kewaunee, Wisconsin. And summing that up in one word is growth. Parallel 44 is another family effort, with Steve's wife and partner, Maria, focusing on the tasting room, sales, as well as other aspects of the business, plus Steve's father putting in his fair share of hours. This is Wisconsin farming and winemaking at its best. So we're back at Parallel 44 in Kewaunee, Wisconsin with Steve Johnson. Steve, how you doing?
Very good. It's good to see you again, Ray.
Good to see you again, too. Glad to see that you've done so well here since our last visit. We're in a totally separate building next door, which is huge.
Yeah, we went through some growing pains. With the success of the place, we were able to expand to another facility, expand the production area. And the vineyard now is at 10 acres, and we hope to continue to grow.
I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, you said you own 35 and your plan was to get to 25. Is that right?
That is the goal. That's a pretty high thing to strive for because there's so much work involved now that I know that. But, you know, like I said previously, we really want to produce a Wisconsin product from the ground to the glass, and that's going to involve growing the grapes and the work involved with that.
And the fact is, I mean, since I was here, those are 4 acres. That's a lot of property to move up on.
It really is. It's very, you know, costly to establish a vineyard, but the labor is also something that's a challenge. And, you know, even though we've been doing this since 2005, every growing season we're learning something that we didn't know before. So it's going to take many years to nail it down exactly the way we want it.
And then after that, it'll change anyway, right?
Probably.
Well, when I came in today, we were talking to Maria about, you know, you've had this very dry summer, and it's been raining like crazy today, and you've had more rain. Of course, this is the time of year really you don't want the rain.
Right. We're reaching that point called veraison, where the vine's physiology shifts from shoot growth to sugar production in the grapes themselves. And so at this point, you know, too much rain will dilute the sugars and the acidity and kind of, you know, destroy the unique varietal characteristics of the grapes. But with really well-drained soil that we have, it rarely is an issue for us. That's one of the benefits we have. So, you know, and things are going really faster than normal. With this heat, I would say we're about 10 to 14 days ahead of schedule.
Oh, nice. That's what I've been hearing in other areas as well. So is that the draining because of this area? We're a little bit on a hill here. Is that part of what's helping you out?
Yeah, we're nestled on some glacial till soil, the remnants of the glacier receding about 10,000 years ago. And actually, this vineyard is the site of a former gravel pit. So literally in some spots, we have more stone than dirt, which makes difficult to establishing a trellis system, but makes the vines very happy because they never get wet feet.
I talked to a winemaker who once told me a story that when he was a little boy growing up on the property, that he and one of his best friends, when they got in trouble, they had to go around and collect rocks out of the vineyard. But he said what he'd learned about that was the rocks kept coming back.
Yeah.
because of the change in the soil. Do you have that kind of experience here too?
Yeah, the frost will occasionally keep pushing up stones. We got everything from pea-sized gravel to boulders that are too big for our tractors to move. But yeah, it's once you have the vineyard established, so it's not so much of an issue. But you know, with the remaining 15 to 20 acres that we expect to plant, you know, we're going to have to figure out a system that's probably a little easier than what we did the first 7 years.
Well, let's hope we don't see a Tyrannosaurus Rex pop up one day. That might be interesting. Yeah. So let's talk about the wines that you're growing here, because I think you've added a couple since I was here last. But let's actually just walk through each one you have just so I can have our listeners can know what you got.
All right. The initial planting in 05 was a Marechal Foch, Frontenac, Louis Swenson, and Wild Grape. And the following year, we planted La Crosse, St. Pepin, and St. Croix. And now we've planted a brand new varietal 2 years ago, which I think holds the most promise for the upper Midwest in terms of a red wine, and that's Petite Pearl.
Petite Pearl, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Yeah, it's a, again, a cold climate varietal. It's a cross between the Riparia of this area and Vinifera. I think there's a little Pinot Noir parentage to this varietal, very small clustered, kind of low yielding. But the wine I've had from this varietal, I didn't even know where it came from. I thought I was drinking a Syrah. So I know the numbers on the chemistries of this juice have been analyzed by Iowa State, and they say they rival that of the vinifera characteristics. So we have, let's say, about 1,000 vines. We'll have enough to produce 25 cases this year, but the following year we'll be close to a mature crop on those 1,000 vines.
Was it here in Wisconsin you tasted it? Was a vineyard here?
I tasted it at the Minnesota Grape Growers Conference 4 years ago in Minneapolis, and it was a brand new varietal. There was only one person that had a nursery that was propagating these. When I found out about it, I bought that place out. So I believe, as far as I know, we have the largest planting of it in the Midwest. I see more and more people talking about it, and I think much more of it was planted this spring. But I think we got a head start on everyone else with this.
Cool. And you said 2 years ago you planted these, correct?
Correct.
And when do you think you're going to be looking at a yield from these?
I think we'll have enough to make a few dozen cases this fall.
Wow, that fast.
Right. So it's usually your fourth year that you have the mature crop. So we actually dropped a lot of fruit from it last week. We probably dropped half of what we had on the vine, but it's all done for the purpose of getting good cordon growth, good shoot growth, so that next year we can really maximize what the vine will yield. And the quality of the fruit will be higher when the vine isn't so stressed. So I wish I had more, but I know that a year from now we'll be talking about hundreds of cases of it.
It'll be interesting to see how that goes over. That's something I would really like to taste. It's just intriguing to hear about that.
Yes, I mean, it has a spicy note to it. The acidity is much lower than a lot of the other red varietals that are grown in this climate. So I really, like I said, I couldn't believe that I was tasting something from the upper Midwest. I thought I was from California.
What are your alcohol levels average around this area for these kinds of wines?
Generally, with a cooler growing season, we sometimes struggle to get the Brix levels that we want. The whites, generally at about 20 Brix, they seem to have reached their mature flavor profiles. So there's a bit of chapelization that'll take place, because I do want balanced wine, which means you're going to have an alcohol level of 11 to 12% on most of these wines. So with the reds, it was a bit of a challenge. Last year it was cooler. This year, I think, on the Frontenac and Foch, we'll hope to get about 24 Brix. When you break that down, we'll end the 12.5%, 13% alcohol level, which I think is a good level for our wines. They're more fruit forward. So that the acidity that we have, the fruit forward components that we have, I think that 12% alcohol range is the ideal range. So I guess it'd be very similar to what you'd find in Tuscany and Bordeaux, some of the cooler climates.
I think it's a good area to be, because the one thing is tough is when you get the hotter wines, it's just not always a pleasant experience.
Right, yeah. It's, you have to match wine with the wine style with the characteristics of the grape. And being in a cooler climate, you accentuate the fruit forwardness as opposed to the body or mouthfeel.
So is there anything else you're looking to? Any other ambitions you have grape-wise? I'm sure there's a lot you'd like to bring in, but of course, realistically, for the property you're farming. And
right. I mean, now that we have 7 years under our belt, there are certain varietals that I want to work on more. I think they hold great potential for the winemaking. We've been working with several growers in the area to encourage them and work with them to expand their production. This year I've relied on hoping to purchase over 40 to 50 tons of grapes grown across the state. So that requires a lot of work, and I'd like to continue to foster those relationships and get more growers out there, because our goal is to promote wine that reflects this area. That's going to require, others besides myself growing these grapes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're working in the cellar, you're running this business. I mean, when do you find the time to go out and visit? I assume you're doing this face-to-face. This is the phone call kind of thing.
Right. Most of them are face-to-face several times through the course of the year. Most of them are within an hour of our location. Most of that's going to take place when you're not busy in your own vineyard yourself.
And I'm sure there's plenty of times you're not busy, right?
Yeah, that's so rare. I would say maybe 2 months out of the year, there's nothing with pressing, immediacy. But, 90% of the time, there's always something we have to be doing out here. If you're a fellow grower, you kind of be on the same wavelength as to what the concerns are. And now that we have a grape growers conference in the state, we have an annual meeting in January, and there's courses and get-togethers all through the year at different people's vineyards. So a lot of connections are made at that point.
There's two things here. One is, it was 2.5 years ago and we did our first interview with you, so a lot has changed in that period of time. I want to come back to the AVA thing, but this Grape Growers Conference, is that new?
This will be, I think, in January, the fourth conference that they've had. And initially, a lot of it was backyard grape growers who wanted to dabble in this as a hobby. But now you're seeing the majority of the members of this association pursuing it as a career or as a business enterprise.
Well, a secondary part of this, too, is when you have these meetings, you get to go see these other places. Maybe there aren't places you would normally get to see. So you get to see what other people are doing, what their setups are like.
Right. And the reality of it is that even though we're in the same state, we have different soils, different microclimates, different methodologies as to what they think works best with certain varietals. It's amazing. Every year you go back and you hear the seminar topics being discussed, and there's sometimes direct contradiction in what was said last year. So that just shows you that it's really in its infancy, and no one has become the expert in this at all yet.
We've talked about this in the past, the whole idea of being in this business, the more you know, the more you have, the more you don't know.
Exactly. Yep. There's no denying that. So you have to be very humble in this business, because Mother Nature will kick your butt. A simple mistake with a fermentation can really throw you for a loop. So, you have to constantly be willing to learn and share ideas. And generally in the wine business, you find most winemakers pretty willing to share their expertise or their wisdom or knowledge, and that's very helpful, because a nice piece of advice from someone can save you tens of thousands of dollars and years of headache.
Yeah, a lot of pain. So I wonder if that you think about the New World wine versus, of course, France and Italy, and we've really only been recovering from Prohibition. Still, you could say that. Is that a lot of the reason why we seem to have such a good cooperation, because everybody's still learning to crawl?
Yeah, I don't know if it's the nature of people who enjoy wine having a more open disposition, or if it's we kind of feel it's all for one and one for all. But there is a certain degree of competition that exists. I mean, with 6,000 wineries in the United States, there's certain regions within the country where I think some winemakers feel that another winemaker may be detracting from their overall business potential. But in this state, I don't think it's reached that level yet. But I think it has more to do with the nature of people who are interested in wine growing tend to have a certain disposition where they're more open and want to learn about things.
Why wouldn't you when it comes to wine, right?
It is. I mean, it's it's something that's been done for tens of thousands of years, and it's required generational learning from one generation to the next to achieve perfection, and that is going to require sharing of information.
Do you know roughly how many wineries or wine growers there are here in Wisconsin?
In terms of wine growers, I'm not sure. I know that there's been estimates of up to 700 acres of grapes in the state of Wisconsin. The number of wineries is close to 90, but few of those wineries have planted vineyards of our size. But our hope is that number will increase, and that those wineries like ourselves with 10 acres will double their size in the near future. But it is very challenging. It's something that a lot of people still hesitate about because of the huge time and money commitment. But for us, it's the point of no return.
Well, and that takes us back to when we first met. You were a practicing lawyer.
Correct.
Working in Green Bay. And I seem to recall you saying your plan was to leave that practice. And you work for the city, as I recall. It's not a private practice.
Actually, the state or the county of Brown.
County.
Yeah.
You're still working there, I guess, right?
Yes. Yes. We have three children, so it's a bit of a balancing act. You know, like I said before, there's so much work to do out here. It just requires a little bit more coordination. It requires being out here in the middle of the night sometimes, especially in the harvest season. When you are crushing grapes and fermenting grapes, it's not really something that you do by the hour of the day. It's you do what the wine necessitates you to do. So that means at 3 a.m, you're out here punching down a tank.
You got to do what you got to do.
Yep. It's the nature of the business.
Well, and your dad works with you.
Correct.
Which I think is great.
Yep. He's out here 50, 60 hours a week, everything from the vineyard to helping me with the winemaking. So it's more of a way of life than a job, I would say.
Your dad definitely strikes me as he has a real passion for this and obviously a lot of pride, it seems, too.
Yeah, I would say if you had talked to him 7 years ago as we were planting the vines, he would have probably thought, you know, what the heck are you doing, son? What proof do you have this is going to pay off? But part of the reason I got into this was I had very fond memories of my dad growing grapes in the backyard and making wine in September. And the smell in the air and the process of it intrigued me. So I think that interest still was in him. And when he saw the interest in this business growing, he's just as passionate about it as I. My wife's father also did that, and she has fond memories of it. So I guess it's kind of in our blood, and I don't know, like I said, it's a way of life. It's just you feel compelled to do it. It's hard to pinpoint a reason, but you just feel it's something within you that you got to do.
Well, one of the things, you get to spend more time outside than the average person, for sure.
Very true, yes. And that means being out there like the last 2 weeks with the heat index of over 100. The vineyard requires things to be done when they need to be done at a certain growing stage. So that means, you know, you have to sit and drink a couple gallons of water a day to get through the day out in the vineyard. But, you know, you get used to it. And if you accept it as a way of life, it's not really a chore. It's just seen as something that is part of the process of being a wine grower.
Or specifically being a farmer.
Yeah, that's true. I often tell people on our tours, you know, the romance of wine is certainly there. But the reality of it often is it's a lot of hard work, and you're farming, and Mother Nature is really the boss, and you're just there to tend and finesse it the best you can.
Do you still get excited when you get to crack open a bottle every now and then, or just maybe, you know, you go back to something you have in the cellar that you had, and it's like, you know, I made that. That feels pretty good.
Yeah, I do that once in a while when I'm particularly at the stage of bottling the next vintage. I like to have consistency, so I'll open up a bottle from 2 or 3 years ago, and most of the times I'm pleasantly surprised. People often ask, well, what do you think is the characteristic that's going to be described as for this particular region of the state or the country? And I think the ageability of the wine is going to be the most notable characteristic. And so I do enjoy that. I think I need a few more years under my belt to actually get misty-eyed and remember what we did. Right now it's just depressive business that you know, keeps you going. But yeah, hopefully there'll be a few years down the road where we can crack open an 08 vintage and go, yeah, I remember that year.
Since you've been doing this for, how many years did you say? I'm sorry, it was six?
The vineyard is on its 7th year. The business is on its 5th year.
Okay, so have you gone back to any of your earlier wines just at this point? I know that's not very long, but, you know, have they seemed to show some ability to age?
Right. For instance, the Frostbite that we sell, it's the oldest vintage we have. It's the 08 Frontenac. And that wine had such a brightness to it that I was reluctant to sell it for the first year after it was bottled. In fact, I sort of subconsciously wanted to give people a heads up with the name Frostbite. Well, it's a dessert wine. It still had an edge to it. But now you'll find that wine has sort of a nutty sherry aspect, and the acidity has really dropped, or the flavors have melded in such a way that the sharpness doesn't pop out as much. So that was a very pleasant surprise. I mean, it went from a wine that I was reluctant to sell to the one that I probably would grab right now if I wanted to drink it myself. So, yeah, it's the ageability of the wine. You know, the acidity is really the backbone of a wine, and if you have a sufficient structure, most of the time the wine is going to continue to get better rather than fall flat.
That's got to feel pretty good just to be able to go back. And again, from that idea of this is something we've created and we're doing the right thing.
Right. And, you know, it takes years of experience to figure out, you know, how your wine ages. And so we can kind of use that experience now to maybe assist with maybe using a different yeast strain, making sure certain things go through malolactic fermentation, the residual sugar that might be necessary, maybe the hang time that needs to be out there on the grapes so that we hit the right spot in terms of, you know, its balance.
This is the end of part one of our interview with Steve Johnson of Parallel 44 Wines. To download part two, go to lifebetweenthevines.com or visit iTunes.